This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
I got two pictures up here, and I want to dedicate what I'm talking about today to these men. These were the people that started the epilepsy surgery program in general at UCLA. Paul Crandall, who you see over here on the left, who died a couple years ago, and Dick Walters, who was the neurologist. And the point that I'm going to try to raise here, this program started at UCLA in 1961. That's how long we've been in the business of doing this. And my career, I've tried to follow and emulate a lot of what these men started. So as commented, my talk is on the epileptic encephalopathies. And I'll cover the following stuff. Well, first, yeah, we have to do this like financial disclosure stuff. So I'm on the data management committee overseeing the NeuroPace material, for which I will not talk about, so I'll get rid of that conflict. From a non-consumer side, I'm editor-in-chief of the journal Epilepsia. I get money from NIH and various other things. So I won't talk about those things either. So what am I going to cover? For a general group, I'm going to cover some recent stuff that's published and understanding how we define epilepsy and when is a person considered medically refractory. We'll then focus on what is pediatric epilepsy surgery, and in concept and principle, it's this treating this epileptic encephalopathy. We'll talk about some of the things we've done here at UCLA through our programs to help contribute to this field. We'll talk about what is pediatric epilepsy surgery, and this involves a survey that we conducted through the International League Against Epilepsy, the ILEE, based on calendar year 2004. I'll talk very briefly about, I think, what the future can lie, which is how surgery in this field can contribute to understanding genetics, and then hopefully close with a discussion about where I see the future. In other words, where and what things should we as an institution be thinking about going forward. So I'm listing here a bunch of collaborators, and one of the themes I want to bring forth that people should understand is that while I'm up here talking and giving you all this data and information, this is not the work of a sole person. Working in teams, and that's one of the themes I want to bring out through this, is working in teams is really what the model system that we've been working on all through this. And again, that started way back when Paul Crandall and Dick Walters began the program in the early 1960s. You do a lot, you can achieve a lot more by working together than being siloed and having a pyramid system. And it's working to get people to work together, which has its politics and issues, but getting people to work together, I think, is something that is very foremost, especially as we're going forward. And the other important person or people that contribute to this are the kids and the families themselves. Now, this is Henry. He's one of my kids here, and his mom, as you can see, made a T-shirt for him to keep emphasizing to me every time I see him in clinic that he's teaching me as much as I'm learning from him. And that also is a significant component here. Without the contribution of the families to this and other programs, many of the things that we learn, we wouldn't have learned. In other words, I see these kids going on year after year after year, and it's the continuous seeing of these kids that contribute a great deal to our understanding. Now, some general stuff, which I think as general pediatricians, you should be aware of. While it may sound fundamental and easy, defining what is epilepsy is not so simple. Now, in 2005, Bob Fisher, who's up in Stanford, put together a conceptual idea of how to define seizures in epilepsy. And this basically is, you know, the idea that there's neurons getting together and fire. Just published in April of this year, in 2014, this has now moved forward to an operational or practical definition of epilepsy, for which there's a couple changes you should be aware of. The standard accepted practice prior to this paper was that you call someone with epilepsy after they had at least two unprovoked seizures more than 24 hours apart. And that sounded very good at the time, especially in 2005, but there was a couple of people or a couple groups that got disenfranchised. one of which was this notion that these had to be unprovoked. So individuals with provoked seizures, and these are primarily the reflex seizures, auditory, visual, and there is a group, they're rare, but there are a group of kids with this, technically could not be defined as having epilepsy, and were being denied services because of that. So the league has now expanded the definition to include reflex epilepsies for diagnosis. And the other one which came up was that among epileptologists, it was pretty clear that a lot of individuals were giving people or felt that people had a definition of epilepsy if they had a particular syndrome. And a good example and classic in that would be someone with tuberous sclerosis. So if a child presents with a new onset seizure, and you do an MRI scan and they have all the characteristics of TSC, the probability that they're going to have a second seizure is probably 80 or 90%. So the league has now offered the opportunity to define someone as having epilepsy in the presence of a known epileptic syndrome where the chance of a second seizure would be as high as it would be in somebody who has two unprovoked seizures. And what that rate is about 60 to 90%. In other words, if you know nothing else, once a person has two unprovoked seizures, the chance of a third is 60 to 90%, and you carry the definition of epilepsy. So these are new characteristics you should be aware of. The league also took its first stab at trying to define when somebody's epilepsy might be finished. The committee, and I was on this committee, had a long argument on what terms to use because cure didn't quite fit and blah, blah, blah. So we came up with the term resolved. And it's defined now as somebody who goes at least 10 years seizure-free off medications for at least the last five. These are expert opinion recommendations. There is no data to support any of this. But it is a first attempt, and you should be aware of what these classifications are. The other thing that you should be aware of is we now have an accepted definition of when someone can be considered medically refractory. Again, this was a consensus report published in 2010. Again, I was on this committee, so just part of the – I was the token neurosurgeon. Okay, they had to have a neurosurgeon on the committee, so they put me on it. I don't know why, but, you know. So the definition there is failure of an adequate trial of two tolerated and appropriately chosen drugs, whether in monotherapy or in combination. Now, notice some of the caveats. Adequate trials means that you actually got them up to a therapeutic level. And tolerated means that they didn't have side effects. So in other words, if you put someone on a drug, carbamazepine, for example, and you end up with a rash, that is not considered an adequate trial. Okay? Once you have failed two of these drugs, then you're considered medically refractory. The definition of failure is the opposite of success. So the committee agreed that a successful trial is one in which someone is seizure-free for a duration of three times the baseline. Now, this is critical because in the adult literature, the people were saying you have to be at least a year with seizures before, and some were saying 2 years. Well, in the pediatric population, that doesn't work because a year is a lifetime in someone who's 12 months old. So the notion is that if somebody is having only a seizure per year and you put them on a drug, then they have to go three times baseline, 3 years, in order for you to consider that trial to be successful. On the other hand, if you have a child having 50 seizures a day, you don't have to wait a year to figure out whether the drug worked or not. Okay? So three times baseline is kind of the key. And these are things that again, you should be aware of and when you recommend you're seeing kids. The other part about general stuff, just to get an idea of just how frequently you might expect to see kids with epilepsy that are surgical, is this nice work that was done by Ann Berg. She probably made the big mistake because she asked me to give her hand in this study. But she did something which I consider quite interesting. She got all but one of the pediatric neurologists in the state of Connecticut to work together. That already by itself is a major accomplishment. They recruited all new onset epilepsy cases from 93 to 97, which was 613. And her study was also very good in that not only did they all have EEGs, but a fair high proportion, 85%, had MRI scans. So that for an epidemiological type study, this is quite good. And the mean follow-up at the time we published this was about 12 years. So the key points that come out of this is as follows. If you have failed two drugs and you have a positive MRI, the chance that additional medical therapy will render you seizure-free is 3% over 10 years. In other words, if you failed two drugs and you've got a bunch of seizures and your MRI is positive, it's really kind of silly to keep playing with the drugs. If the MRI is negative, you got some play. So a key factor in your evaluation of kids with seizures is that once you failed two drugs and your MRI is positive, you're at risk. The other aspect from her study, which was kind of which was worthwhile, is she followed all these kids for a number of years. And we use, and the figure's the same in kids as in adults, that roughly a third of the individuals with new onset seizures meet the definition of medically refractory, seizures persisting after failure of two drugs. However, it also identified, that's this group here. So in other words, you take all those and you take away the traditional idiopathic epilepsies. This is the 3 hertz frontal lobe spiking wave, absence seizure type of characteristics. And looking just at that group, again, about a third meet the definition of medically resistant. However, if you ask the question, how many of these kids are having at least a seizure per month? Kind of the minimum definition of what it might take to evaluate for probably pre-surgical evaluation, the rate is half of that. So there is this group of kids and adults in which they meet the definition of medically refractory, but they're having less than a seizure per month. We know very little about this group. We don't know how much they're cognitively impacted. We don't know hardly anything. This is a group that in the research literature has not been well investigated. If you then go on to see how many in her cohort eventually underwent some sort of surgical procedure, it roughly is less than half. This is kind of, the range is actually sort of between 4 and 6%. So of 100 kids who have new onset seizures, the number that will eventually or possibly epilepsy surgery candidates is roughly 5 out of that group. So if you're in a general practice, and depending on how many kids you see with epilepsy, the number of kids that you're going to be that you're going to see that are probably going to be epilepsy surgery candidates is pretty small. So in other words, this is treatment of a pretty rare condition. So if you just do the math, in the U.S., about 4 million live births a year, you would expect there should be about 1,700 operations per year. In our 2004 survey, there was about 500. So there are probably a number of kids, even at this small rate, who are potential surgical candidates that we do not have an opportunity to see. So what is the difference in the approach in kids with medically refractory epilepsy in which you might consider doing surgery? Now, in adults, this came out of the 2000 NIH CURE conference, which brought together consumers and experts together. The goal was no seizures, no side effects. For kids, we have to add into this issue about what seizures do during development. And for the developing brain, the goal is to eliminate seizures as soon as possible so that you can optimize the development and hopefully secondarily improve quality of life in these kids. And again, this was from a consortium that was put together through the ILE in 2006. So it's this developing component to the brain which is very different. So that gets us into this concept of what is an epileptic encephalopathy. Now, this is considered the impact of the brain on the brain of seizures or the continuous EEG activity during the course of development. This is over and above any impact on the brain of the underlying cause of the condition. So this is additive. And we refer to that again as this epileptic encephalopathy. If you look carefully, there's evidence for this even in adults. But the age or the duration effect is on the order of 15 to 20 years to see it. Where it's most applicable and where you can see it in your practice is in the kids, especially in the very young kids. Now, let's think about this a little bit, because this is conceptually, this starts to make sense. This is an old slide, but it's one that works. You know, remind everybody that, you know, in kids, the first couple of years in life, you get 80% or more of your brain growth, brain size, whereas the body lags behind. Most of that growth is not new neurons. It's really the connections, the synaptic connections between different neurons and the connectivity between the brains. Let's think about, and you know, any parent, you know, you see the development of your child in that first year, 18 months of life, from basically, I mean, it's a brainstem prep. I mean, a baby that really is functioning from mostly reflexes, to a child that's walking and telling you no more often than anybody else that you have in your life. That is a tremendous time. Now, let's think about, what does a seizure do to your brain? And if you think about it, it's kind of like when you're sitting down at your computer and it freezes. So a seizure is when you get this electrical activity that bombards your brain, and your brain's default mode is to shut down, to freeze and shut down. Now, on your computer, you reboot it. And as it reboots, you know, it's confused. It's trying to find out the files that it left someplace. It's taking a while to re-going and get itself together. And it's confused. Same thing happens in your child's brain in that sense. Now, if that happens once, that's fine. But imagining this happens 50 or more times a day. Is there ever a period of time in that child's development that their brain is not being scrambled by the seizures? And it's the term that was actually used, and we were talking with a media person once, is that seizures hijack your brain. They take it over. And it's that repeated shutdown, reboot, that is what is it affecting the brain in during that developmental period. And that is then what's leading to this epileptic encephalopathy. So if you kind of conceptually think about it, you know, normal development, you know, kids take off and they have a very, very clear line of development so they can reach their normal IQs. Kids with seizures develop, but they develop at a rate much less than the normal. So it's not like they are losing milestones. And you hear people use that term, a loss of function. There is not a loss of function. There is a failure to gain the normal milestones. And what we've learned is, if you stop the seizures at some point, you don't regain it. The difference is lost. So what happens then over time is that you end up further and further from the norms, such that when you get to be an adult, you end up with an IQ in the 50 range. You know, what does that mean? As a kid who has barely, if any, communication skills, can't dress, take care of themselves, or take care of the activities of daily living. That is that effect of the epileptic encephalopathy. So, and it occurs when you've got seizures that start very early, very frequent, and a known substrate. So let's hopefully now, let's see if this works. Oh yeah. This concept of treating this historically has a start here. In 1986, there was a program, the program started here, and you'll see some of these faces. Several of now have left or gone on. Don just, I think, finished, retired in June, right? Warwick left, he was the neurosurgeon at the time. He left here in the late 90s. Alan, I think, is left here and some time ago, and Harry went to Detroit. But it was this group, and they focused on something in particular, which was this thing called hypsarrhythmia and infantile spasms. This was uniformly known to be associated with the severe form of that epileptic encephalopathy. And what they observed was this notion that in some of these kids, and this is not a bad slide, this is what MRI scans used to look like in the late 1980s. Okay? We had a 0.3 Tesla machine here, which wasn't so good. And Dr. Shigani, who was part of the PET program at the time, was able to do FDG PETs for research purposes, and they were defining areas of hypometabolism that turned out to be areas of structural abnormalities, cortical dysplasia. So what they did was something at the time considered pretty crazy, and this was published in 1990, again, the historical point here. And if you'll notice, in today's world, this would be kind of, I don't know how you get this through. They had 13 kids with infantile spasms. They found in 5 of them that there was this hypometabolism that all related then to finding cortical dysplasia. They operated on several of these, and there were four or five of these had the MRI, which was normal. They operated on several of these, and they got seizure control. At the time, this was considered heresy. This was a generalized epileptic condition. How could you be operating in a generalized epilepsy condition with a focal lesion? And at meetings, there were people that would volunteer to be expert witnesses on an opposing lawsuit if any of these cases ever went to trial. So this was heresy here. But it was the point I'll try to bring here is this was a collaborative team working together, and they moved forward on this, and they were able to show success. So let me give you an example, and this is going to be William. Now, William came to us when he was just about a year old, and we brought him in for telemetry, and this is his video EEG, and you'll see I'm moving around here. He'll suddenly stop. There he is right there, stopping. Mom will reach over and push the button. So he had seizures, and his EEG, in his case, was actually quite good in that it was very focal over his right hemisphere. Now, so he had started seizing, less than 1 year of age. He had tried more than two or three drugs. He had a positive MRI, which I'll show you, and he was seizing at least 40, 50 times a day. He was a kid destined for that IQ of 50. So in his case, in order to get control, we took him to the operating room. And this is my version of the hemispherectomy. This is the bloodiest thing you'll get to see. We'll get some other stuff. And this is where we started. And this is what it looked like when we got done. Now, what happened to William then as over the next several years? And through the diligence of families and digital video cameras, this is what he's done.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Do you want to show him your teeth?
How you doing? You say hello?
Yeah, you smiling? Yeah. Hi, William. Good walking on your knees. You're
having siblings around to help compete is helpful.
Almost. Almost. Awesome. High five. You're a good runner. Go, William. Go, go.
Now, I've shown you certainly his motor development over several years. Is there anything else to him? Well, let's take a look.
Is it the first day?
Yep.
Of what?
For school.
Of school? Are you going to kindergarten?
Mm-hmm.
And how old are you?
5.
Awesome. That sounds like a good day. Can I have a thumbs up? Okay, let's count them.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12.
Yep, that's what I count.
I can make a coat with this.
Can you write the number 15?
Okay, 15.
Okay, 1 and 5.
Yes.
Yep.
Yes.
Or step. Pick up really.
That far.
Now he's got a paretic hand. And this is pretty much a helper hand. So what this illustrates is what we're doing. We are trying then to treat this epileptic encephalopathy by doing an intervention that controls the seizures. Is he normal? No. But he's far better off than if you'd let the seizures persist. In order to get him the cognitive abilities he's got, we had to make a sacrifice, in this case, a physical handicap, to optimize his mental abilities. And this is a key component in our decision process for children with epilepsy. Stop the seizures. The other important point from this is that the time of intervention then has a critical role in how much you can save. The further down this length you go before you do an intervention, and the worse the developmental difference between normals, the worse the outcome. The earlier you can identify, the least the outcome. So this has important implications then on when and how you should be doing the intervention. Now, what's happened with this idea ever since? And again, since started here, and there's been several publications since. This is from the Cleveland Clinic looking at surgery in infancy, where they basically showed similar data in that improved cognition was associated then with becoming seizure-free. The idea has also then been excluded to other forms of potential epileptic encephalopathies, that is continuous spike wave discharges in a without seizures necessarily. And this condition called CSWS, where again, you see this evidence that if you intervene, there can be improvement. And it's even kind of gotten to the point where surgery for what we consider a very bad epileptic condition, the Lennox-Gastaut syndrome, where in the presence of a lesion, you can often get seizure control. This study did not address the question about DQ increase numerically. It said that there was positivity, but there were no numbers here. So this concept, again, started here, has now grown and gone, and is really the fundamental forces that we talk about when we talk about surgery for children. So this raises then, when should you refer a child with seizures to a center for possible evaluation? And again, this is through the ILEE Epilepsy Surgery Consortium. For all kids, it should be those who have persistent seizures after failure of two or three drugs or unacceptable side effects. This is especially important if you're having a child with at least a seizure per day, because that's where that you get that. And even if there's circumstances where the MRI quote is negative, and the reason I'll say that is that in many places, an MRI at an outside center that's negative becomes positive in our center. For kids under two who are at the greatest risk for that epileptic encephalopathy, they should be referred urgently. If you've got a child with medically refractory epilepsy in this age range, they really should be seen, because the risk is just too high. And then there are those special circumstances, and this relates back to the definition of epilepsy, where you have epilepsy syndromes which are clearly either rare or difficult to treat, in which a center should be seeing them. And these include conditions like cortical dysplasias, tumors, tuberous sclerosis, and other conditions. And I'll show more of this later. So there are some pretty clear ideas. Kids shouldn't be sitting in offices having lots of seizures. You should know why. You may not be able to fix them all, but you should know why. Now, our contribution to this in our program here, and I want to highlight just a couple, and then we'll talk about some other things later. The one thing that, when I took over the program, was we still do a fair number of cerebral hemispherectomies. And there were different techniques that have been described over the years. And in real simple forms, the two variants is you'd either take the whole brain out, which is a form of anatomic hemispherectomy like I'm showing here, or you do something which is a functional variant where you take out parts and disconnect the rest. And there have been various things that have been proposed. The usual challenge is for which technique to do from a surgeon's perspective has to do with the ventricular size. When the ventricle is pretty big, it doesn't really matter what technique you do. It's pretty successful, and you can get away with just about doing much of anything. The challenge is when you get a kid like this. This is a child with hemimegencephaly, where the ventricles are not only small, they're malpositioned. And when I took over the program, we had a history of doing anatomic hemispherectomies, a version called Rasmussen-style hemispherectomy. And so I looked at the outcomes and sort of said, you know, we're not doing so good in one, and the risk for risk of the surgery was not so good for the anatomic. So what I devised was a variation on the resection theme, where we take out a core area in the center, leaving a ring of tissue around the side, and this should allow then for the disconnection, which you have two goals. You want to disconnect this hemisphere from the ipsilateral brainstem, which you do by taking through the thalamic area, and then you want to disconnect the two hemispheres through the corpus callosum. And so what we've done, we took then and that procedure, and I compared it against the existing procedures that we had done at UCLA, And this was in conjunction with Barbara Vanderwell in anesthesia. And the key thing I want to bring out here is that since kids are various sizes, you have to come up with sort of a metric about what relates to blood loss. And so the magic number here is this. If the magic number here is 30, so 30 cc's is, or 30 of this number represents a red cell mass of a total body transfusion. Okay? 30. So in our hemimeg group, doing an anatomic, we were averaging multiple blood transfusions to get them through an operation. And while we still had a lot of blood loss, with my procedure, it was substantially less. And across the board, this is substantially less. So by modifying the procedure, we could get the achievement for seizure control safer, less blood loss. And the other part about by comparing the procedure was when we looked at our hospital stays, both in the ICU and the total hospital stay, we were significantly better. So, you know, we're in this age now where we have to show quality metrics and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, we were doing this a decade ago, where we're already kind of looking, how can we improve and make the experience and the surgery safer? And this is one example. The other example, which has been in collaboration through Noriko Salomon, and others in our contributing, was looking at ways in which we could reduce or eliminate the need of putting intracranial electrodes into kids. Could we use non-invasive technologies to define the area to be removed so a child would have one operation and not a bunch? And working with Noriko and others, she's developed we had FDG PET, but what she was able to do was help us in refining this to define areas of much more subtle metabolism. Now, you remember that MRI I showed you a while back from 1986. So in today's world, this would be more typical. But even in today's environment, and this is an example of a case that was sent to us at 15 with 4.5 years at 4 seizures per day, we could lateralize to the right, but the imaging had been run outside and inside is negative. And by putting the PET scan on top of the MRI, you're able then to identify areas of more subtle hypometabolism. And if you come back and look at this, you say in hindsight, well, yeah, there's not as much the definition here of the white matter as there was before, but that's in hindsight. So, and then if we combine this then with a MEG study where we get dipoles over the same area, we have now matched enough information so we can go in and using just electrocorticography do a focal resection without the need for grids. So these are the two areas that we've kind of championed here, and we'd like to champion even further in going forward with epilepsy in our cases. And just an example here of how this has contributed to identifying the subtle dysplasias. Now, what is epilepsy surgery in kids? And this will be the result of this 2004 survey that which I was involved in, where we got 46 pediatric centers from around the world, from 21 different countries, and they gave us all of their surgical cases for the calendar year 2004. So there's about a total of 1,100. It was all cases, including palliative cases. We did this originally with the idea that everyone thought that different regions of the world were different, that we'd have different populations. And the answer was there was very little difference around the world. Epilepsy surgery in kids done in Asia is very similar to what it is in North America and in Europe. And some of the key factors. Most of these kids begin with their seizures very early, almost half by the age of 2 years. Two-thirds have STALI seizures or greater. Again, representing then those groups who are at greatest risk for the epileptic encephalopathy. The epilepsy evaluations, virtually everyone gets MRI. It was kind of interesting. Not everyone, though, gets video EEG. In many places in the world where that's expensive and you have a positive imaging, some are going straight to a surgery with maybe just interictal work. The other factor is that if you look, the total percentage of intracranial electrodes is just about 28%. Across the globe. So a lot of people are doing these without invasive monitoring. If you look at resections, still the two-thirds or so are focal resections or lobar, primarily in the temporal lobe. In comparison, let's say, to our program, well as the general world, about 20% were hemispherectomies. About 40% of our volume is hemispherectomies, reflecting the younger ages and kids that we typically see. If you look at the etiologies in these populations, cortical dysplasia is the most common, and if you include hemimegacephaly, which is sort of the worst of the worst, the combined total would be close to 40%. Interestingly, 20% are about tumors, which is number two in the adult population. And what you should notice is hippocampal sclerosis, which is the most common in adults, is number four and under 10%. Again, reflecting the difference that you see in kids. And then many of the things that we talk about are rare. Look at those under 5%. Hemimegacephaly, tuberous sclerosis, this condition called Rasmussen's, Sturge-Weber, and the, most of these are cavernous malformations. So even among rare conditions undergoing surgery, there are rare things within the rare, which we have a tendency to focus on. Now, just some examples. Cortical dysplasia. If you got, you know, where's the dysplasia here? Got to look pretty carefully. If you look, there's a heterotopic area sitting down here, and there was hypometabolism. Now, at surgery, this is how I get to look at the brain. So to give you orientation, the eyeball's over here, the ear's over here, the top of the head is here. This is the Sylvian fissure. And if you look, the cortex isn't all that bad. There's a little bit of fullness and thickness in the temporal lobe, but the sensory and motor cortex are basically kind of where they should be. That's a milder form. A little more severe form. This kid, you see by MRI, has an almost lissencephalic-like picture here in the temporal occipital area. Question was involvement of the motor sensory system. In this case, there was hypometabolism and some weakness. And again, at surgery, same orientation, a little worse. One of the things that you typically see is that the veins are far more prominent. And here, the Sylvian fissure goes back. It doesn't have the normal cutoff. And this is definitely abnormal in the temporal occipital area, but you still can see a defined area of the sensory motor cortex. Well, what about something worse? I showed you this picture before, kid with hemimegacephaly. Now, you got to turn yourself around. The eyeball's over here now. But this is dysplastic cortex all over the place. Yeah, you see the Sylvian fissure. There's something of a cleft here that probably is trying to be the motor sensory system, but you don't. Everything else is just totally dysplastic and abnormal. And this is an example, then, of the most severe form, hemimegacephaly. Tumors, kid with a temporal area that with contrast enhancement shows an area. And at surgery, you took out a D-net, which is sitting right there that you can see. Here's an example of a child with a perinatal stroke. Didn't start seizing until age 4, and then at 10 came to surgery. And what does that look like? Well, that's what that brain looks like. That's where the brain should be, and all you see is that leftover material on the brain. Here's an example of hippocampal sclerosis. A kid with tuberous sclerosis complex, and this is a typical situation where we don't look for a single site. We have a problem is that we have multiple tubers, and you got to figure out which tuber is the offending one. In this particular case, this child underwent a MEG scan, and we got lucky. Kid had a seizure right in the scan, and we were able to localize to a single tuber and take that area out. This kid has been seizure-free with the exception of occasional reactive seizures with temperature and fevers thereafter. Kid also has an identical twin without seizures in the same tuber load. Hypothalamic hamartomas, that's one example there. And here's something that we should be able to identify. This is called Sturge-Weber. This is where you get the vascular malformations on the surface of the brain. And at surgery, it looks something like this. These are the tendril of vessels that's sitting on the surface of the brain associated with Sturge-Weber. Rasmussen encephalitis is a condition of a chronic inflammation that's associated with one side of the brain. And at surgery, what you see is this patchiness, pale patchiness that lies over the surface. Now, how do we do with seizure outcome? And this, again, is from the 2004 survey where this is seizure is seizure-free without problems. And again, it's about 55%. The key thing we learn from this, though, are two major points. The first is Seizure outcome is higher when you have an MRI positive lesion. So the class 1A was higher if the MRI was positive. And the next factor was, did you completely remove the lesion? If you completely remove the lesion, your seizure control rates are about 83%. Incomplete is substantially less. This is not, so that this, and this has shown up in multiple different etiologies. So it doesn't, this is a very simple message. I mean, we're surgeons, you know, knuckles crack on the ground. We need simple messages. All right, success is find the lesion, take it out. It's that simple. Incomplete resections, though, are associated with poorer favorable outcomes. And if you're MRI negative and it's based poorly on EEG, again, incomplete resection, essentially, you're not gaining seizure freedom. This then relates to the evaluation process where we make a risk-benefit analysis. And the risk-benefit from the surgeon's side is, do you have a lesion? Can you take it all out with a acceptable deficit or situation with the family? Because I'll tell you something. If you now start to an incomplete resection at a 16% control rate, you have to begin to ask the question, should you really be taking this child to surgery? Similarly, if you are MRI negative and you really don't know what area you're taking out, should you really be taking this kid to surgery? You're exposing them to all the risks if you can't get seizure control. In our own setting, I'll just highlight a couple of things I've done in collaboration. One of the things that we have as an advantage of is this 20-plus year history. So one of the things we were able to do, I've looked at recently, is how have we trended over the 20 years of our program? And working with Jason Hopman, Jason's one of our neurosurgical residents. He's now doing his pediatric neurosurgical fellowship. So he's someone we'll get into pediatric neurosurgery. But what we've shown is that over time, and with our experience, we've improved at 5 years out the number of kids who are seizure-free and the number of kids that were never seizure-free. So you can learn if you keep following your kids. The other thing that we've done in collaboration, again, I'm a believer in collaborations because I think this is where you get work done, and this is with Paul Krogstad in infectious disease. We came up, you know, this issue of what do we do, because a lot of our kids have fevers after surgery. And so with a student who's now gone on into a residency, we looked at 100 of our consecutive cases here. We identified 16 infections in those 100 cases. Of interest, most of those infections were not in the brain. We're doing major operations, and the infections turn out to be in the lung and elsewhere, which raises the question of when do you look for. Fevers, which were classified as greater than 38.5 Celsius, were noted in 43% of the patients. And in there were two patients with infections that never had fevers. So fever is not necessarily a reliable. And white counts of over 15,000, there were 5 infections that never had this. So the bottom line out of all this is that fever and elevated white counts are very common after surgery, especially in our larger operations, and they're not predictive of infections. The only thing that's predictive is a positive culture. This helps because we were sending stuff off to the lab. In fact, we still send stuff off to the lab, which is probably inappropriate, where what we really should be doing is just culturing, and not just culturing CSF. We need to be culturing other things. And again, this is a way of reducing our costs and also then looking at our risk ratios and where we should be looking. And it's just a curve of the fever curve, where typically we get these fevers at a week out in our populations and usually in our larger resections. Another example, collaboration. The other thing that's involved that I want to raise is since about 2003-2004, seeing what the world of genetics was like, I took the opportunity to begin to store some of the brain tissue that we removed at surgery, with the idea that eventually we might be able then to use it as a way of understanding some of the processes. And here, working with Joe Gleason, who was then at UC San Diego, I called him up one day and I said, let's take this condition like hemimegacephaly. Here's something that affects one side of one part of the brain. And as far as we know, with a few exceptions like Proteus syndrome and other things, that's the only organ that's involved with. When we look at germline mutations, most of the time germline mutations lead to multiple organ system issues. TSC is a good example. Skin, kidney, heart, etc. How can you explain what obviously has to be a genetic condition if it only affects one part of one organ system? And the only thing that made sense would be a somatic mutation. Now, the beauty of that is that with next-generation sequencing, you can then do a experiment, which is pretty straightforward. You take the reference area, the diseased hemisphere, and a non-disease reference within the same person, blood, saliva, do a genetic screen, cross them, whichever shows up in the brain that doesn't show up in the other reference is probably your likely culprit. Joe got interested, so we took a bunch of our kids with hemimegacephaly, and indeed, we found mutations in the mTOR pathway, not in the TSC1 or TSC2 genes, but mostly in the PI3K and AK3 portions of the pathway. And these are somatic mosaics. We've actually been able to get, so 40% of the surgical cases that I've done, we've now been able to find this with rates, depending upon the technique used, of the mosaic, somewhere between 5% of the cells up to 40% of the cells. Now, to me, this is, and I'll talk a little bit in the future, to me, this is where we should be leveraging some of the things here at UCLA and going forward. We have some unique opportunities here that I think to have influence. So this is where I get into this issue of where I see the future directions. If we think about it, all the work I've been showing you is an example of collaboration and team science. And I think, in my own opinion, I'm kind of looking forward in what we should be doing more of this in a broader scope within pediatric clinical neurosciences. There's been an explosion on the adult side of various genetics and other avenues. We should be leveraging that in our areas of population. And areas to look at include things are, what are the genes of normal brain development? Well, there, having a friendly neighborhood neurosurgeon with tissue, you have an opportunity to actually get to work on the material at hand. And this is, I think, a great opportunity that we probably have not leveraged here as successfully as we could. And this is something that we have shown historically to be an area that UCLA can excel in if we put the teams in some way together. This is that leverage. And we've got, for example, the Intellectual Developmental Research Center is a highly sophisticated basic science group. And so there are various places in our fields that I think we should probably try to work on. This includes things like concussive injury in the young brain, brain tumors and how they grow and their interaction. Can we develop strategies like they use in the adults, vaccines, those sorts of things. Can we better understand? You know, and this is particularly important when you look at our weaknesses. I mean, you know, we have to admit we have a few weaknesses here. We don't have a freestanding 200 or 300-bed pediatric facility here. We're not going to ever be a high volume throughput place. Where do we begin to use and leverage our strengths? And what we've done, of course, from the epilepsy side is we've focused on an area, developed it quite nicely, gotten a national, international reputation, and I think we should be doing the same in other areas of clinical neurosciences for kids. I think this is really, to me, where the leveraging the future that we should be looking on. It requires investment. Investment in people and resources. But to me, I think this is part of the way we should be going forward. And to finish, I'll make two comments. Again, one of the things that I've learned in all this is that we don't work alone. And over the last 4 or 5 years, I've had the opportunity to work with some of my parents. And these parents, of course, have formed their own nonprofits. And so I've worked with the Rasmussen's Children's Project. This is Seth Wahlberg, whose daughter was treated here. And he's put money in, even though his daughter's had surgery, but he's put money in with the idea of, can we take this really bad disease that takes over a normal hemisphere and ruins it, and can we do something to it and fix it? The Hemispherectomy Foundation is another one. And I would also encourage all of you to use in our own practices our message or ability to get our message out to the public. TED is a great example of that. And there are opportunities for us to teach. This is not marketing. This is teaching. Our role in the university is to transfer knowledge. And we often use it as a media opportunity where we really should be using it from within our educational side. How do we educate the public as to what's important? And with that...
Thank you.
For
listening to my story.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.